This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week, we're going to continue our conversations with another stage illusionist. Last week, we talked with Franz Harari, and this week, we're going to be talking with Rob Lake, who is a magician who is really on the rise. This young gentleman has performed all over the world in casinos, arenas, and theaters, and also on all the major networks on Netflix and Hulu, as well as Fox and ESPN and ABC, and boy, you name it. And of course, America's Got Talent. A lot of that's going to be discussed over here on this week's episode. And also, he's had over 800,000 ticket sales during his career and over 70 million views of his YouTube and Facebook channels. And so anyhow, he is just a rock star. And I'm going to repeat many of these things I just said in my introduction of here shortly. But before I introduce him, I want to remind many of you who may not be watching these videos I have been posting on YouTube. Some of you are more visual than you are audible, whatever it be. So if you like watching these conversations, I have been posting many of them over the past few months on YouTube, and I can really use your help if you would please subscribe to my channel. That's youtube.com/Texas Magician. All one word, no space or anything, Texas Magician. So youtube.com/Texas Magician, please subscribe. And there you will be updated whenever we have each week or whenever I release a new podcast that's going to be on video there, plus other kinds of content that are magic related I know that you're going to enjoy. And also, if you have an opportunity and you have not yet liked our Facebook page, of course, that's facebook.com/TheMagicWordPodcast. Well, anyhow, we have, again, another great conversation with another super illusionist, someone who, as I don't know why he's not the next David Copperfield. David is not finished yet by any stretch of the imagination, but I think this next young gentleman, Rob Lake, will be nipping at his heels. The shows I have seen of his video are just phenomenal. It looks like the next David Copperfield special. So I am wishing him all the best of luck. And if you have not heard of him, if you have not seen him, I recommend that you go to our website at themagicwordpodcast.com for this week's episode, number 614. So you can then watch some of those videos, or just go to his website then also to watch Rob Lake's video. He's got a lot more, obviously, there. Anyhow, let me step aside and let you hear our conversation this week with Rob Lake here on The Magic Word. This week, we have someone who is all the way from Oklahoma City and also someone who travels around the world. This is really pretty fantastic. I've got Rob Lake with me, who is an illusionist, and I don't get an opportunity to speak with a lot of illusionists, and he is someone who has not only traveled from Times Square to in Atlantic City to Las Vegas and Lake Tahoe, but also he's been a consultant to many on television series, feature films, and theme parks. He's created many effects that you've seen on television, particularly like America's Got Talent. That's something that's very popular in the U.S. A lot of people have watched him there. He also has over 800,000 career tickets, I should say tickets in his career that have been sold, and also over 70 million views on YouTube and Facebook. Absolutely amazing. Caesars Entertainment had named him as one of the top illusionists in the world, and I really don't get an opportunity to talk with a lot of illusionists, so that's why I'm so excited really to get a chance to talk with my friend here today, Mr. Rob Lake. Hey there, Rob, how are you doing?
Hey, Scott, thank you so much for letting me be on your show. I've listened to you for years, and it's an honor to be here.
Well, I'm flattered. Thank you very much. I'm glad that you do tune in and being one of my listeners. And also, I know you are an illusionist, and we're going to talk about that. But talking about another illusionist, the reason I wanted to talk with you is because of our mutual friend, Kirby Van Burch, who had said, hey, you need to talk to Rob. And I said, I know Rob. He's just up the road from Oklahoma. You know, I lived in Tulsa for a long time. That's where the guy kind of got involved. Yep. But this is about you. Tell me about how you met up with Kirby.
Well, you know, Kirby is one of my dearest friends in the world, and I would not be here because on the podcast or in magic if it weren't for Kirby. when I was 10, I saw his show in Branson. It was his first year there, and in the audience of his show, I got hooked immediately. I still remember watching his show. And I became a Magic fan, a geek, and, you know, I wrote letters and fan mail. And a couple years later, he remembered me from the letters and from going back to his show every year. And he became my mentor over the years. And when I was 20 years old, I took a very extended permanent leave of absence from college to become a full-time magician. And I actually lived in his guest house.
Yeah, permanent.
but I moved to Branson. You know, I didn't have any props or illusions. And here I'm trying to become an illusionist. So I moved to Branson and I lived in Kirby's guest house. And I worked on his show as one of his producers of his show, working on the production. But I'd spend the free time, making a promo video or learning the business. So for about 6 months, I lived and worked under him. And then, before I first got a gig. But by my first few gigs, he would loan me props and equipment. And my very first promo video was, his illusions in his show, which was exciting because I had, out of the gates, I had this really awesome promo video. But I also had the ability to borrow or rent equipment from him for all of my gigs. So it was a great relationship. So we've helped each other out over the years. You know, I would help him work on new material, or I'd come back to town for his opening of a show at a new theater. And at the same time, he would always loan me props or support me or make introductions for my career. So we've been friends for many, many years, and I wouldn't be here without him.
That my question about illusionists, then, how do you get shows? I mean, where do you perform outside of some place that's able to accommodate all of those illusions and bringing things in and the props and the if you have animals and dancing people who choreographed all of the show and everything. So when you're making this video, to whom do you send that? I mean, does it go to agents? Does it go to Las Vegas? What's the process?
Back when I was 20, I thought, okay, I've dropped out of college. I'm going to be a magician full time. I thought tomorrow I will get a big Vegas contract. I was very ambitious and
have on the rose colored glasses. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. But honestly, if I didn't think that way at the time, I probably would have never been courageous enough to go for it. It wasn't easy at first. I mailed out hundreds of videotapes to agents for cruise ships or bookers or casinos or theaters. And I tried to get gigs and I tried to make it happen. And it didn't work for a while. My first kind of gig was in a theme park overseas in Asia. And honestly, at the time I thought, oh, I'm on a billboard. I've made it big. But, looking back, there was green AstroTurf on the stage. It was, the show is a theme park in Asia. It was, it was not a gig I'd be proud of now, but at the time I thought, oh, I finally made it. It's going to happen. But I've been lucky. From there I did a few cruise ships back in the day. I did some performing arts centers and casinos, and I've been really lucky to, after the first year or two of struggling and no one calling me back, a few breaks, and then I've been pretty lucky to work solid for most of my career.
Well, when you did finally get that opportunity over in Asia to work that AstroTurf theme park stage, was that something that was booked by an agent, or was that something that
I think it was a friend of mine heard about the gig and referred me. Uh-huh. But I, of course, once I was talking to the bookers, they had to see my video, which luckily impressed them a lot. Mm-hmm. And for that gig, I was a rush scramble. It was a lot of things overseas, especially our last minute. It was like, can you do this gig? It starts in 3 weeks. One of those kind of deals. And so
that's what I've gotten from cruise ships, when they can say, hey, mm-hmm. can you be in India? We need you to fly out over here in 10 days, or even can you be down here in 3 days? Yeah.
And then the first time I got a cruise ship gig, same thing. If somebody wanted to go home for Christmas or a break, it was a last minute, last minute 2 or 3 month holiday run that someone, I was filling in for. And that's how I got a cruise ship. But I was scrambling. I didn't have hardly any props. I sold them these props from this video that, Kirby helped me make. And so he was gracious. He actually took one of his illusions out of his show for me, and I took it to Japan for 8 months, his motorcycle illusion. So it wasn't a small illusion. It was a big – it closed act one of his show, and he was so supportive and helpful. He actually just pulled it out of his show and said, take it, because he knew I needed to get something – a break to happen. And he said people helped him out in his career. So it was just an act of kindness, and we've always helped each other like that. But then in the meantime – I drove to Branson in a U-Haul, rented U-Haul, brought the motorcycle illusion back, built a crate for it. And then in the meantime, I was working with local carpenters and, building the other props for the rest of the performance. And the show was such a hit, we got extended. So Kirby, I sent him an email saying, hey, we're extended, and I got to keep your trick a little bit longer. but then when it came back, when it came back from Japan, it was his off season. So he gave me the advice. He said, you should make a copy of this so you have your own. In other words, he said, I'm not going to take it out of my show again. But
right.
But he was generous. So,
so is that what you did? Did you go and have it rebuilt?
Some fabrication shops and made my own made my own copy of it. And mine, you know, I think his was built by David Mendoza, you know, the illusion builder, and mine is an exact copy. So over the years, we, you know, I replicated things I built for his show. We trade each other. We've loaned each other props and traded props all the time. And whenever I bought an illusion from him, he's a lot shorter than me. I'm really tall for an illusionist. I'm 6'3".
Wow.
So I don't fit in a lot of boxes, so I don't fit in any of his props. But when I bought like the cane cabinet illusion from him, you know, I had to completely rebuild it because I, you know, it came up to here on me. It came up to my chest. But we've had a great relationship and he helped me out. So that's, thanks to Kirby for starting me off in magic and supporting me the whole way and for getting me on your show.
Wow. Well, and then from kind of working on cruise ships, I guess they saw you perhaps at the theme park or?
No, I think I just nagged them enough with enough calls and emails and videos.
You just pursued that. Yeah.
And you know, it's one of those things that, you know, for cruises, especially my experience was they're not looking for someone until they need someone. You know, they have the agents and the ships, they have their acts they trust, they like until they need they're not usually actively looking for new entertainment. They like the people they've had before. So I got in because an illusionist was going all the way for the holidays and I got to go and fill in for the holidays and it worked out and I got the contract.
Yeah, and they liked you, I guess, enough to keep you on a little bit longer after the holidays into.
I did more ships after that. Honestly, it wasn't my I loved it. The first week was great, but I got really, really bored on the ships. I'm really ambitious and really driven, and I was doing one or two shows a week and on vacation. And I felt unproductive, so it wasn't my favorite thing. And after the first few contracts, I started looking for land-based gigs, and I've stayed on the land since.
I have heard for those who are wanting to get on cruise ships, I was just lucky whenever, timing-wise for me, however, an easier way to get on, I understand now, would be during the holidays when you're saying like you're replacing somebody. And if you just say, like in the subject line of the email, you're saying available for holidays, because most magicians aren't. They've got other shows they're doing or want to be their family. Or they've been on, like you said, you've been bored and you kind of want to be off. And so if you are willing to go and spend Christmas and New Year's, those are the people they want. So you have a better opportunity, I think, to get on.
Absolutely. And I heard of several people. My advice, if anyone wants to do cruise ships, Fred Becker wrote an amazing book, which I think you can still find online. And that tells you everything accurately about it. And I called him a million times for advice and wisdom. And he was always so gracious to give me, you know, answer my calls and support me and give me advice. But if he's the expert on cruise ships. And I think he's the one who told me to really exploit the fact I was willing to work Christmas and holiday time.
Yeah. So it has been a while since you've worked cruise ships. And I know that it is, like you say, just work a couple times a week. But going back to that for just a second, as far as the people who were your assistants for the illusions, obviously you have to train them just like you do with theme parks and everything there too. Did you bring someone with you when you went to Asia to begin with and then also the cruises go ahead?
No, absolutely. So for me, I've always tried to be as self-contained as I possibly can.
Sure. Easy to work with.
Well, that and also the assistants do it your way. They've trained you, worked with you. You know, they're, when I travel my current show, we have 20 people that travel with us.
Holy moly.
And it's really, and some of these people have been with me for 5 or 10 years. So it's really, but like when we do auditions in New York, we might have 300 dancers show up for 4 roles we're casting. Mm-hmm. So it's really, you know, we do a cast a wide net, but pick the people we want, but we try to keep them for a while. So when I did the Japan thing, I brought 2 assistants with me, a magic tech assistant and then a female assistant. Mm-hmm. And if you know about the motorcycle, you know why I needed a male magic assistant for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And then for the cruise ships, I did take a girl, and it was the first time. I actually remember the cruise ship. It was really hard to find a dancer who was not working, who was willing to go work for the holidays, mm-hmm. and also was last minute. So we found someone who it was a girl I'd never worked with before. She had been in other magic shows, and she was referred by some of my main dancers. But there's scheduled conflicts. I couldn't get there's a Christmas show some of my girls were in. They couldn't come, so we had no choice but to use this new girl. I take her out there, and she gets so seasick.
Not good.
She was miserable. I mean, it's like we knew as soon as that first show was over, she was off the ship. But luckily, the ship had really great dancers. Mm-hmm. And some of the dancers had gone to college. Some of the dancers on the cruise ship had gone to college with some of my actual show dancers. So we had these connections. We knew each other. Hmm. And they'd already been in the other magic shows. So after the first show, we sent my temporary assistant home because she was miserable on the ship and just so seasick. And then we used the show ship's dancers. And I paid them cash every week to work my show.
Yeah.
But luckily the ship accommodated me, gave me the rehearsal time to rehearse with him and catch it up. Because the other girl, we brought her in for a week or two of rehearsals before we sent the equipment out. So it wasn't like we met for the first time on the show day. We actually, my assistants actually trained her in person before we left.
Before she left. Whenever you do bring along your tech assistants, particularly on a ship, when I've done it, I have tried to run my own tech, and I mean they have their own tech people who are, and I probably should have been, should leave them do alone to do their job. They know what they're doing, rather than me trying to do my show plus all my tech and hitting my ankles together or pushing buttons or whatever. You know. So what do you do? Do you have somebody in the booth who is part of your tech people pushing the buttons, and or how do you?
Yeah, so it's a combination. So if it's a touring show, I bring in everybody. Like right now, we bring the dancers, the crew, the stage crew, the sound, the lights, the video people, the laser people, the pyro. We bring in everything now self-contained. Okay. But if like when we do a residency, like at Harrah's Tahoe or Atlantic City, you know, we're working with a union crew. Mm-hmm. So my tech director will come in for the install. And he will be there the first week of the show to train their operator for the sound system. But they're using the running show off of my, you know, we run the entire show off of computers. And they know much more about this than I do. They know more about these equipment I own and these road cases with my name on it. But it's all run on computers. And so if we're having to have a union crew or a house crew person run it, same like a ship, we will provide them our show computer. And then my tech director will spend the install week and the first week of shows training them so they understand the show cues.
Right.
Luckily, these people are really good at their jobs. They know how to make the show sound great. It's more about just learning the cues. And honestly, I'm not a band with multiple mics and inputs. It's, you know, luckily I don't try to sing. So for them, you know, the hardest part is just learning the show and the show cues, and that just takes a few days. And luckily it works out. But I'm also comfortable because I know my tech director won't leave the show until they're proficient and ready to go.
There are so many moving parts to a large show like that. And when I was talking with Franz Ferrari recently, of course, his are mega shows where he's performing also in these outdoor arenas that have 100,000 people or something.
Right.
And so it's different for that, but yet even for yours, which is large enough, I would think, in going to college campuses and other places wherever they have all that. And I guess on campuses, they don't have union, of course. They just have people who are kind of learning the job training on the job, I guess, who are students learning how to do all that tech. And so do you work with them and kind of teach them?
No. For that kind of show, if it's a one-night or a short-term gig, then we bring our whole team. You know, my sound person will run the show, set up the show. We will have, you know, there's like a local labor call, 20 or so hands to help unload the trucks and set up the show, but they're working under my team. But my tech director and my audio guy have done the show for 5 or 6 years now, and I think they can read my mind, know how I need things to sound and look. But you know, like they are always there for short runs or short runs. There's not enough time because if we have a one stop day, you know, either we have a show that night or the next day, it's not enough time for someone to learn the show. So everyone's got to be trained and experienced in the show at that point. Just the extra hands are there for pushing the cases out of the truck or
just
running
labor,
cable.
Basically.
Exactly. It's the stage, the roadie labor.
Right, right. I assume that you have some roadies who are with you who are showing these people how to do that then, too.
Absolutely, yeah. We, like I said, I have a great, great team of that sets up the show and helps run the show.
What are some stories that you've had that have had some growing pains, I guess, where you had a smaller show and you're trying to do that and, you know, you're busting your knuckles out there, you know, basically, before you go in to do a show?
Absolutely. I'm very, I guess, type A personality. If I'm walking through the theater and I see things aren't done, I will jump in and help it. And my crew is, Rob, go do something. No. They said, we got something, but that's not set up. They said, Rob, we have 6 hours. We're okay.
Yeah.
And I look around, I see things not set up, and I try to jump in and help, and they try to get me out. You know, we've had, when I first put the water levitation in my show, it was built really, really poorly because, you know, Kirby Van Burch had Doug Henning's water levitation and Kirby loaned it to me several times. And I used it all the time, but I really wanted my own. So I had it built by a builder in Vegas. And it was terrible. It was everything about it was wrong. And the problem is it had all these water jets that were movable and it had this microscopic size water reservoir. So these jets would vibrate from the motors and from the water pumps. And all of a sudden they'd be pointing, so all of a sudden the entire water tank would be draining because all the water just were shooting the water off the illusion into the audience, onto the stage, and we were flooding. So halfway through the trick, there's no water left because the water shot everywhere, and then all of a sudden, you know, we got in troublesome venues because we were flooding stages and it wasn't intentional.
Not a good thing.
So, but luckily we took it to a, we completely rebuilt it locally. We scrapped the entire thing and took it to like a local group that builds pools and fountains, and they helped us build it, you know, build it right. And it's been great since. But early on, that was the thing. But we did a gig a couple years ago, and we showed up to a venue, and this is one of those perfect storms, actually. My tech director had some – I think he had a wedding. He was in some event. He was flying into the gig from somewhere else. He wasn't with us from the day before, and his flights were canceled. It's one of those things that, you know, first part of the morning, we're on, you know, early before, you know, sunrise. His flight's canceled, and we're looking for – and there's just literally no way to get my production manager and tech director to the gig. So I said, okay, don't worry. I'll roll up my sleeves. I'll come help out. Not a problem. And he's on the phone trying to help out, but there's no – logistic way to get him from point A to the theater before the day after the show. So he said, okay, just go ahead and reroute yourself, join the tour the next day. But we get to the theater, we pull up, the semi trucks are there. It takes five semi trucks for my show. And always we unload the lighting trucks first, because the infrastructure has to get the lighting and the sound. The infrastructure has to go in before the illusions can go in. And I get a call, I drive by the venue. I see the trucks are there. I want to be the nice guy, so I go down the street to this coffee shop. I'm going to bring all the crew, the local crew, our hands. I'm going to show up with coffee and tea for everyone, just make everyone like me from the get-go. And I'm in line at Starbucks, and my lighting guy calls me. He said, Rob, we've got a major problem. I said, okay, I'll be there soon. He's like, no, we've got a major problem. So what did he said, there's no loading dock.
Oops.
What do you mean there's no loading dock? Well, the venue and their tech pack and all these advanced, you know, our rider says, you know, you need a loading dock. If you don't have a loading dock, you need a special kind of forklift to get the stuff off the equipment or off the trucks and you need extra hands. The venue, through all of our advanced work and planning, the venue had failed to tell me there's no loading dock.
Okay.
So, you know, and of course, these cases, these illusions, these lighting cases are heavy. You can't lift them off a semi-truck. Even if you had a bunch of hands and ramp, you know, they're stacked high and the trucks are full. So I think it was like 4 or 5 hours before they finally found a forklift to get there. So for 4 or 5 hours, I was just standing around with absolutely nothing that could be done until the forklift gets there. And then, you know, just a scramble until, you know, until the show came in. So just things like that are always – it's live theater. It's live entertainment. And the show still had to start at 7 p.m., you know?
Right. The show must go on.
At 7 p.m. It's the show must go on. The audience doesn't know. They don't care. So I think we had to change a few things. Like one or two things might have got swapped out or cut out just for time's sake. But, you know, missing a key person and, you know, we couldn't get the trucks unloaded until halfway through the day.
Wow. Was that just a one night and a one off kind
of
thing?
That was a one night thing. So by the next day is in one of those things we told the venue, we said, you know, you really should make a whole page, you know, in your info pack that says we have no loading dock.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm planning is something that, you know, and our rider has, you know, after that we made our rider have giant sections about the loading dock too. It was already mentioned in there, but we made a whole section in our tech rider now about, you know, you must have a loading dock because we have large illusions.
Live and learn. Yeah,
exactly.
That would be certainly a difficult thing. I'm surprised they hadn't come across that before because you, if not were the first large illusion show, there had to be other kinds of shows in which people were bringing in things.
Yeah, you'd think so. So, I mean, it's always something different or something fun. You know, we had at a show one point, you know, all the ClearCom, the headsets for the crew, all of a sudden was getting police chatter through the whole thing. There, you know, some frequency issue. So they're, you know, they couldn't find any channel without the chatter. So they were having to do cell phone conference call with each other to communicate. So it's live, you know, it's fun. The show always has to go on.
Sure. What about animals? Have you worked with, let's say, wild animals in particular, with lions and tigers or aside from just doves or anything? Or even doves?
Yeah. So back in the day, you know, when I had my first video with Kirby, you know, I would use Kirby's tigers, and he would let me use his cats way back when. And it was right after the Roy attack. And the ironic thing is, right after the attack, because I had, you know, a couple of clips on my promo video with Kirby's cats, I got these gigs all of a sudden because people, like, right after the attack wanted tigers on stage.
Really?
It was shocking. Now, six months later, we had to edit them out of the video completely because it was not something people wanted anymore.
Right.
But we got a few gigs, and one time I think it was because Kirby had ABC or someone was coming into Kirby's show, and he said, "Hey, I'm," and we always were responsible. The cats were well cared for, they were transported well, they were putting the illusions well. I wouldn't do it again, but you know, at the time it was a thing. But you know, there's one time we couldn't use it, and we ran past with the Tiger King, if you saw that documentary.
I did.
And we said, can you provide us a tiger? And he said, sure. And the tiger showed up.
He was up in your neck of the woods, up in Oklahoma, too, right?
Uh-huh. Yep, thanks for the reminder. And he came to the show, and he had they were transporting the cat. You know, we wanted to meet with him, see if it could work out. And, like, they were showing us their transports. They were transporting a tiger in a cardboard box. And we said, no, this is, so we basically severed ties, said, you know, this isn't going to work. We'll give you, you know, we said, you know, we'll give you tickets to the show, but it's not going to work. He saw the show. It was sold out. It was in Oklahoma. He thinks that the name, the key to success is my name. So Joe Exotic went to the trademark office and trademarked the name Rob Lake.
No way.
True story. True story. And if you see the Tiger King documentary, that in the first episode, he's performing little mall shows as a magic show.
Yeah.
He had trademarked my name. It was going around performing as Rob Lake. I had to get lawyers involved and threaten to sue him and get him, just to get him to stop using my name and to release the trademark.
Because you had success, obviously, and he was trading on success.
He thought the success was all in my name, I guess, my guess.
Yeah.
Many years later, Carol Baskins, also from the documentary, had, I guess, found the filings and the paperwork from him, you know, and having to get the court order to get him to release my name. Mm-hmm. And so she contacted me asking if I would help out. I said, you know, that guy's crazy. I said, I want nothing to do with him again. But I think we sent her all of our information from, all of our back and forth, documents on it, saying, hope this helps you, but keep us out of it.
Yeah. And obviously you got your name back. And he was.
I did. Yeah. So hopefully he'll never use it again. But yeah.
Wow. Well. Hopefully not.
So that was my animal. I had a 2-month animal experience there that really wasn't anything besides a promo video. But then I have a rescue dog, and the rescue dog travels with me. So I'll bring him on stage for a little cameo every. Mm-hmm. He loves the attention, so he'll come out for a show and tell. And honestly, it's just an excuse for me to get to see him, during the show.
In the short time you had worked with animals, and then of course then working with Kirby, do you know if you've ever had any kind of mauling or any kind of episodes where the tiger was ever out of control? No.
Nope. Okay. I never experienced or saw I saw them as well conditioned, well trained, well cared for, animals. I never saw any dangerous situations.
Yeah. I haven't talked to Kirby about that, and I'm just curious if he'd had experienced anything like that then as well. So with the animals that you had then right now, rescue animals, is that something that you talk about during your show as far as helping shelters and that kind of thing?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I like dogs more than like people. And the hardest thing about traveling around the world, because I live in hotels 90% of the year.
Sure.
And the hardest thing about traveling is not having a dog. And so I was looking for a dog for years, and I finally found the most perfect dog. He loves to travel. He's so chill, so calm. And so I really bring him on the show for no reason other than halfway through the show, I kind of miss my dog. I want to see him. And it melts the audience. But I come home to Oklahoma every year to do benefit shows for animal rescue groups.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the biggest applause points of the show is this is Roger, my dog. He's a rescue dog, and the audience always applauds. So I'm able to, in the show, have my own PSA about, the importance of rescuing animals.
Right.
And people relate to that. They comment on it. He has his own Instagram page. My dog does. And,
wow.
And it's great. And they always ask if why is he not in the autograph line after the show? And, he it's too much petting. It's like having all these. Everyone wants to pet him, and that he doesn't like that as much. But he loves the applause. He loves going on stage and the attention to see me. But he just chills in my dressing room for the autograph time. But it's definitely something I support and always have and always will.
I know Lance Burton is very big into that, and the shows he does now in retirement basically are only if he can promote that rescue animals on television.
Yep, exactly.
And live
shows. It's my hometown show. Yeah, every year. Mm-hmm. Every year I come home, and I've been doing it for, 5 or 6 years now. It's a full, we do the full production. We fly my cast and crew in. We bring all the semi-trucks to a performing arts center at home. And we do, I pay all the costs, so it's a free show, and all the money goes to these animal groups.
When you have designed your show, did you, and you already told me, you started out, of course, using a lot of the props that were from Kirby, and then later started duplicating some of the same things. Did you, I know from, we're recording this, and I could see behind you some photos or some posters of Blackstone Sr. and Doug Henning, who were both illusionists. Have they influenced your style and also the types of illusions you think the audience likes to see?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I love history. So I love reading the history, especially of the greats of magic, like Carter or Thurston or Keller or Servais Leroy.
All of Caveney's books, basically.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I've read them and reread them, and I've gotten so much inspiration, even just the inspiration to be creative. Mm-hmm. The fact that these guys can build illusions and engineer these masterpieces, which are still what almost exclusively what is performed today. But the fact they built this without power tools, is amazing to me.
Wow.
The fact they built this without Home Depot, William Robinson, who is Chung Ling Su, where does he even get these ideas, or how long would it take him to build things like this Chinese lantern illusion that's like, sounds like a technological masterpiece, and he built it, over 100 years ago without power tools. How is that even possible?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then how could they even, these things are made of steel and glass. How could they even load them into a theater? So I'm inspired by them, even especially inspired by the creative process they had. And it's inspired me to do more. Like, I was working on an illusion for my show. I always loved the artist dream illusion that Doug did, and then Lance did, and then Kirby did. Mm-hmm. And I think I can't remember the exact chain, but I think Lance let Kirby, you borrow his illusion, or there's some connection there. And so Kirby, gave me his, and I love the artist dream. But then I was working on my show, and I was going to put it in with a Decolta chair. And then I talked to Mark Parker. Do you know Mark Parker, the illusion designer?
I do not.
He is from England. He lives in Singapore now. He's a great magic consultant, and he's written several illusion books. And he's a great guy and a good friend of mine. And I was performing in Singapore for a month or two, and Mark and I were hanging out. And I told him, we were bouncing ideas back and forth. And I said, hey, here's what I'm working on. What do you think of this? And he said, Rob, he said, Decolta chair is a marvelous illusion, but surely you can come up with something better than what's been done before.
Mm-hmm.
And then he threw it back in my face a few days later. He said, you always claim you love those guys and how creative they were, mm-hmm. yet you're performing something that's been done before by other people. So so it really inspired me. So
it was a challenge.
It was. And the thing we came up with, I'm so glad he pushed me that way, because I would have, done it. But he really threw back in my face these guys, saying, they were so creative. Why can't you reinvent something new? So, he really challenged me to start from the ground up, and just as an experiment in playing and creativity, and we came up with great stuff. But I think I love the creative spirit of them. And honestly, their stories, everything that's performed today really came out of the shows from Carter or all the Caveney books, as you said.
Yeah.
I mean, really everything that's done, especially Doug, I think they were really good at finding the treasures in those books.
Mm-hmm. And in Doug Henning's case, as opposed to, let's say, Copperfield, Doug did one unrelated effect after another one, and they were always wondering. He was excited about that. David Copperfield has little vignettes where things happen, and he tells a story. So there are mm-hmm. different types of performances. And then Blackstone, from what I had seen in pictures, stills as well as some low black and white video, he was slowly walking across stage, or he was talking with the audience, or let's say doing the birdcage, or maybe the buzzsaw illusion, or whatever, from large to small. But he seemed to be able to break that fourth wall. Everyone had their own style. What is it that you feel is your style of trying to break that fourth wall, and how do you present your magic?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. So, and a great analysis of those guys. I read an article, actually. I remember I was in Japan on that first contract at the theme park, and my family would, mail me care packages that would have all my magic magazines, the Lincoln Ring and yep. stuff. And there was a really great article, and I remember like red marker highlight and circling by Marvin Roy, and he was talking about how and that article really, I think, helped shape that, because it was the start of my career on how, because I think I started out more boxy, more theme park like, more like Doug, where it's yep. like, here's a trick.
Right.
And how Marvin Roy, and I think, I don't remember the exact quotes, but I remember circling them, but he basically said, make it all about you. The common thread is the magician. Right. The common thread, and he referenced Copperfield. If someone's going to get cut in half, it's going to be David. He said, and so Marvin Roy was saying, look at David as an example of, of how the success of David is because I think David becomes the thread of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, my show now, it's just me having a great time, having fun with the audience. So it's probably more like me as a host or stand-up comic. But I try to take the audience through theatrical production. We have a lot of scenery. One of my friends at the Disney company described my show as a Disney-sized Broadway musical magic show. Because, I might perform an illusion, but it has a grand scenic, a lot of scenery. We have trucks and trucks of stage effects and
wow.
theatrical scenery. So for me, it's me as the host, as the conduit, but I'm taking the audience through the journey of what's magic to me and what my experience is. And taking them through how I discovered my illusions and my history through magic. So we try to create it. So it has peaks and valleys of a journey. So it's interesting for the audience, but we also take them into these immersive theatrical worlds.
And it's about you and your life and your
Correct.
Journey,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which, again, people want to know about the person. This way, mm-hmm. people remember you and not necessarily the magic. You don't want the magic.
And there's a famous quote, the magician's more important than the magic.
Yeah, yeah. When you talk about the backdrops and props and everything that you have and the flats and whatnot, I know that takes up a lot of space. And I think of someone, yeah. for an example, like Matt Franco's show in Las Vegas, where he has a lot of digital pictures mm-hmm. that are projected. And it seemed that would be so much easier to carry. Have you thought about going more high tech?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm actually working with some famous park companies on some theme park attractions. And the new trend, even in those realms, are digital projection versus hard scenery. So for me, my personal preference is the 3D, the real tangible scenery. It takes up a lot more truck space. Like my water levitation fountain illusion and the entire set fill an entire semi truck because there's a lot of set pieces. So that 1 4 minutes on stage fills an entire 53-foot truck just for that one. And we don't use the set for anything else. It's just that thing. So, but for me, I like the tangible things. I think projection is amazing and video walls are great. But for me, I love the tangible hard sets just because especially if, I think in person it's perceived better than a projection of it. It feels like the real deal. You know, I have Egyptian columns for my Sands of Egypt routine. And we've done like we've done some virtual shows where we use video wall only. But I still prefer the real set because it just looks it's more tangible. It just feels more realistic and more theatrical to me.
Yeah, I think David Da Vinci also uses some background projections and things like that then, too. But you've got a very good point then as well, Rob, because I was thinking it could be people might be thinking if he's using an interweaving some digital technology with old-fashioned real things, they might think how much of this actually is real magic that he's performing as opposed to camera trickery, if you will.
Right.
It's kind of hard sometimes for the audience to try to differentiate that. Jamie Allen is a magician from the UK, and I did, and he's known as the Eye Magician, which he's doing a lot of. And you've seen his show, very good. And I think he has to balance that new technology being on that cutting edge with also letting people know that the AR that people are seeing when someone brings them up on stage is a real deal. They're really seeing that, you know, kind of thing, as opposed to camera trickery.
Absolutely. And like when I was, you know, probably 11, 12, the first time I saw a flat screen, it was a computer screen. I had the idea for a, you know, an illusion, which I sketched out and tried to explain to people for years. And it took, you know, long, long time for me to be able to build it or figure out how to build it. It was my TV appearance, which is where I appear out of a TV screen. It goes up and down these poles. And I've had a lot of people call and ask me to buy it. And I haven't let anybody buy it, even though a few people, of course, have, you know, ripped it off. But that's something that the TV, the technology is not the magic. It's part of the magic, you know.
Right.
It's the conduit for the magic, but the TV is, you know, you could still do the illusion with a portrait or other thing. It's just the TV is a high-tech version. It's not relying on the technology to be the magic, I guess.
I would think it would be harder to sell that knowing what the public knows about technology and everything today.
Oh, I think so. I think it's, you know, we have a few illusions that use the TV screens. I have an illusion in the show where the front door of the box is a TV screen, so whatever digitally happens to the girl on the screen happens in the box. If I cut her in half on the screen, open the box, she's cut in half.
Clever.
If I, you know, delete her, like you would delete something on Photoshop, you know, she's gone in the box. And you know, I can clone her and make another girl appear with her.
Sure.
So things like that we've played with. But again, it's not relying on technology to be the trick. You know, it's like the prediction box, you know, hanging in the air. I think one of those magic history books, you know, it's like the old-fashioned way. It's a piece of paper in a box. It's not a printer in a box. It's a, you know, paper in an envelope. It's the simple, isolated, clean stuff that still works. So I think the technology needs to supplement it, not be the effect.
Speaking of television, I want to go in that direction whenever you got, well, you've done a lot of television and working on all the networks as well as America's Got Talent. And I'm sure you get that question a lot as far as moving your way up. Did you go up like three different levels or how far was it before they finally said we're moving on to somebody else?
I did three live performances, but there are a few more episodes in there, you know, the results rounds and the, you know, the recap rounds. But I did three performance shows on the show.
And did they tell you what to do? I remember talking with Kevin James, and he was saying there was something he wanted to do one time, and they said, well, we want you to do this other thing. And they had the option, apparently, to in the contract to tell him what to do.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing real about reality TV.
Yeah, let's be clear about that.
Yeah, there's nothing real about reality TV. And, you know, for every minute you see on TV, there's probably 10 hours or more of footage they film that they don't air. They filmed all these scenarios and backstories and tried to think, and you never knew what they're going to film. And
really?
And they even filmed a segment of me and my parents' home with it. They hired a child actor to play little me running around and we around my parents' house and you're performing magic tricks on the back porch like I used to. Mm-hmm. And we filmed these really great segments, these really great scenes where – you know, the camera would swipe here, then the camera would turn around, and I would have changed places as the actor. So, you know, the kid was looking in the mirror, the camera pans around, it's me looking in the mirror. Really great stuff. And they aired that, and then they never aired on TV, but they edited it, but then they changed their narrative about me at some point, and they never used it. So, they called me for 10 years to do the show, and we said no because of the contract. And finally, they offered us this last time in 2018. They said, send back the contract with every – mark out whatever you don't like. Well, we marked out almost everything because they can own you for life in that contract.
They would be your agent, basically. So they,
oh, yeah. Well, that, there's like a salary cap. There's your agent, your manager, your marketing consultant. There's, I mean, the contract's publicly available. People can read it. And it's something I didn't want to sign because, you know, we're already performing shows. And they called and said, you know what, send us the thing back. And I said, okay, we'll look into it. And I planned on doing one episode because I was already booked the rest of the year. And I said, you know, I can do it. But I said, the only opening I have is this one weekend where we film something. And they said, okay, well, let's do that one time, because a lot of people go on the first episode, they wow you, then they just kind of fade away. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll see them again. But when I went to the show, I travel a lot and I don't watch much TV. I honestly have never watched the show. I haven't even watched my episodes. I've seen my clips, but I've not even seen the full show.
Yeah.
I said, wow, this is a big deal. There are over 250 crew members working on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this is a huge deal. I knew it was a big show. I had no idea it was that the magnitude of the show. So we do the show, we do the illusion, it goes great. And then as soon as I'm done, I call my team. I said, we got to figure out how to do the second round. We got to figure out, this could be really big exposure for us. So I figure out how to do the second round, but I'm on tour in Europe for the entire, like, 6 weeks they're filming round two. I'm on tour in Europe. So I have to convince European promoters and venues to cancel my shows, reschedule them, pause it. I have to have a duplicate crew in the U.S., so it worked out. So I had a duplicate crew in the U.S. who had all my equipment ready to go in L.A. for the taping of round two. I finished a show at 11 p.m. in Frankfurt, Germany. Within seconds, I barely made it to the airport on time for my flight.
Oh, boy.
I flew all the way to L.A., went straight from the airport to the studio. I never went to the hotel the entire time. I'm in L.A. filming all the behind-the-scenes features, the interviews, the segments. I film my performance. I film the judge rounds. I film more behind-the-scenes stuff. I'm there on camera. I don't even go to the hotel the whole time. I just film.
Mm-hmm.
I leave the taping of the results round, fly back to Europe to continue my tour.
Okay.
And I had duplicate, you know, crew. So the illusion, you know, we pulled the illusion. I performed. So it was already in L.A. We had crew there set up, and they had already staged and lit and ready for me. So I walked on stage and did it. But I mean, I'm still exhausted from that time. I was in the Bahamas performing in Atlantis for the summer. And I had to leave Atlantis a week early to film the final version for the show for ATT.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something. Once I realized the magnitude of the show and the exposure, I definitely wanted to worked like crazy to change my schedule around to make it happen.
Well, that's the thing. I think a lot of magicians have to appreciate what AGT does for you, and that is to give you exposure. But you have to have something for them to do. When they had called me in the past, I was like, I never did it, only because I don't have a show where I want to put butts in the seats, so I don't need that marketing. And I think for people who have a show in wherever it is, and you're just trying to get your name out there, that way you can use that as a credential, certainly on your promotion material.
Oh, definitely, you know. And I think the other thing is, like, you know, they build illusions for people for the last rounds. You know, we've seen
I didn't know that.
Don Wayne, who passed away last year, I absolutely adore Don, and he worked. You know, I had the pleasure and honor to work with him on several projects. But he was a magic consultant for seasons, and told me that, you know, they were building and buying stuff. So here they came for my last round. They were trying to. They definitely choose from your inventory what you're going to do, and they choose what you're going to wear. They put the, they give you. They said, here's the music you will use. They really dictate a lot of your performance.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to be ready for that, or you have to be ready to walk away. But, you know, they watched my show and they said, we want this, this, and this. And I was like, cool, but I know how much you guys paid for someone else last year. Can't you, you know, I've got these ideas. I want to build this, this. Will you pay for these to be built? And they said, no. And they said, you know, they said this is actually a blessing for us because we had so much stuff already available that was already done. And honestly, a lot of the things that have gone bad on that show are because they are under rehearsed because they've been building it last second, last minute, and they're doing it on live TV and Murphy's Law.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, but I want you to pay for this stuff to be built. And they like, no, you've got enough stuff. So they really, you know, they pick and choose what they want out of my inventory. But I tell younger kids and other magicians who've asked me, I said, make sure you're ready to go with five or six really, really great, strong routines that are 100% ready now, because you don't want to go on live TV with something you've never done before.
Oh, of course.
And you want to have it so seasoned, so done, because things happen. Like, I was on my And the third round we did was the live round, and I did my TV appearance, which is my invention, and I've done that since 2011. I've been doing that on my show, and I do it almost all my shows because I love it.
What's the effect?
Where I appear out of the TV screen.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah. It's my opening illusion in almost all of my shows, and we were doing it on AGT, and that show, you know, the first few shows were pre-tapes. You know, so if there's an emergency problem, they could have stopped it. We didn't have to, but for some of the other acts, they stop and reshoot. But this one is live, like live on NBC. Mm-hmm. And it's the live rounds. It's the most viewed things. I think they had 16 or 17 million viewers tune in live. And, you know, without giving away secrets, I have to get loaded in the prop, of course. And I'm there, but because of the scene change time, the cables, this has to strike off before the motorcycle can go out. So this has to be put on stage first, so all the other scenery is built around it. So I have to be in this thing for like 15 minutes because they actually had a dance troupe before me, and they pre-taped the dance troupe earlier in the day because, you know, putting 65 kids on stage takes a while, and you can't do that in a commercial break.
Right.
So they had like a 15-minute block from the last act that was live to commercial break to the dance troupe to the next commercial break to me was 15 minutes. So I'm loaded in here for 15 minutes.
Trying to be quiet and not moving around.
Well, you know, I mean, it's hot. I had to put fans in there because, you know, the TV lights are already hot. And I don't want to come out of this thing melted.
Right.
And you know, but it's a live audience. It's a Dolby Theater in Hollywood with 4,000 viewers. Yeah, 4,000 people in person.
People in the audience, right.
Live audience, you know, millions of people live at home all around the world. So I'm in this thing, and all of a sudden, you know, they're the countdown. You know, my heart's, you know, when you're on a stage that big, I don't get stage fright anymore, but you feel the magnitude of the show. You feel the reach of the viewers. So my heart's, you know, racing a little bit more than normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear, you know, 2 minutes to live, 2 minutes to live, you know, and there's a countdown music, and the hype man's out there. They're throwing balls around to keep the crowd excited and energized. And,
yep.
And then they're saying, okay, bring the judges back. The judges come back from commercial break, and they're in the table, you know, 90 seconds to go. And then I hear all these expletives from the crew. Now, when I do the show normally, all the video content is built into the illusion because that way we can control it with the motors because the video has to match up and down with this up and down thing.
Okay.
For some reason, AGT wanted to run the video themselves. So with minutes to go, maybe it's 2 or 3 minutes to go, I hear all this stuff from the crew. They lost video signal from their cable. So with minutes to go, they're running a – so the TV is saying no signal. All I'm in there saying the TV is saying no signal. Now, no one's communicating with me.
So, I mean, feed – meaning the live feed is not going out?
Feed. So there's the TV that's the critical for the illusion has no data coming to it. It lost signal.
Wow.
So with minutes to go before this goes live on TV, they're running a new data cable, which is, you know, thousands of feet away to their TV truck, an SDI cable, this thing, trying to get this video fix here. I'm in this thing with – I'm helpless. I'm stuck in there. Not knowing what's going to go on, and knowing I'm seconds away from being fixed, and they're climbing over the thing, so I'm getting squished and stepped on, and you know it's these, they don't know what you know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm smushed, smashed, my face is getting pounded, and it's not going well. I can just hear from what they're saying that this is not going well.
Okay.
And then you know they're doing the countdown: 30, 29, 28. And I'm about to go live on TV, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're 8, 7, and then they say, okay, go. And I just hear these footsteps running. So on the clip, you can see these legs of people running on the live TV, wings.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know what the problem is. I have no idea, but the TV starts going on, the music's going on. I mean, what do you have to choose? I'm literally in the dark, coming out on live TV, not knowing what happened, what's been happened, if it's going to work. And then when I come out to appear, there's gaff tape, there are wrenches, there's all this extra stuff everywhere. I'm like... and I go out and I perform and I have no idea if my open illusion worked or if it just was saying no signal the whole time.
Sure. And
so, but luckily it worked. Luckily it was one of those miracles at the very last second it worked. So
it all came together actually miraculously.
It did. And one of my best friends from college was in the audience, you know, watching the show that night. And he's a journalist and a news producer. And he said, oh, this isn't good. So he was taking pictures and documentation in case that something bad happened. You know, I'd have a case against him for sabotaging me. But that show is actually live, you know, live. And so from, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I wish I'd stuck to my guns saying, you know what, our video system works. It's never failed.
Mm-hmm.
We'll control our video.
But they insisted on doing it their way, obviously.
They insisted on doing their way. And I have no idea. I mean, if that said no signal or happened on the live thing, I have no idea, you know, what kind of, they probably wouldn't even want to figure that out because, you know, on the judging thing, you know, it could have been screwed up because of them.
So of the variety of venues where you've performed, from casino showrooms to colleges to television to theme parks and to cruise ships, which of those really is your favorite?
I love the performing arts centers. But honestly, most casino showrooms are the same as performing arts centers. Mm-hmm. I'm a theater lover. My love is I love to see shows in London and on Broadway, New York.
Is that what you had studied when you were at school at OSU OU?
Even before I was into magic, my passion was production. My heroes still are Walt Disney or Steven Spielberg or, you know, Broadway directors like Michael Arden, who's a friend of mine now, and Stephen Daldry. I get inspirations from really good entertainment. So whether it's the Disney theme parks or Broadway shows or great movies, that's where I get inspiration. So my passion, even before magic, was always that realm.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel most at home in a real theater and performing a theatrical show.
Is that because you also feel that you are working with professionals?
I mean, the union
crew or whoever else that's in the theater.
I could also tell you horror stories of non-professionals in theaters.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think it's more about the environment and the experience that you can create. And, you know, if the theater is your palette, you can create a whole different experience versus, something else. That's my comfort zone. That's my world. That's where I thrive and where I go to play.
Is it also because you have a large enough stage to accommodate the illusions you have as well and all that too? When you put the shows together, do you do your own choreography or do you have a professional who comes in and they keep...
I work with the directors. I've got some great directors I've worked
with. Good for you.
And one of them is Michael Arden, who's a really genius Tony nominee Broadway director who's really a genius, and I'm so honored he's a friend and helping me out now too. And then another guy, Ed Gregory from Vegas, who's a really great director too. But, you know, it's they've got to understand magic. It's a big learning curve for them to understand magic because it's so different than every other genre.
Right, it is. Mm-hmm.
And not just the magic technique, but just the relationship a magician has with an audience with a show. You know, it can't be too far into a play where you lose the audience.
Well, what about scripting? Is that something you work on then yourself, or mm-hmm. do you have someone else who comes in and looks at the show and suggests things to you, or you brainstorm with someone else? Or
Absolutely. It's a team effort, and honestly, it's funny because every time you write a script and plan a script, once you get in front of an audience, at least for me, the whole thing changes. It's amazing. But a lot of my scripts have just developed over experience and years. You know, we have the outline or the lines, but things just feel natural and come. But there's definitely a script writing process for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also intuitive enough and have trust myself enough that if I'm trying a new script, I let it flow naturally and come out how it, because performing without an audience or rehearsal is completely different than with an audience in a live show.
Oh, that's, I think, with whether it's close up to stage, the two things you can't practice are timing and misdirection. You actually have to have an audience there. You can do everything you want in front of a mirror, but until you actually get in front of somebody, it's different.
Totally, but you still have to give, you know, before I worked with the directors, you know, I leaned too much on that stuff, and the directors really, it was awkward at first, but they really made me rehearse all out to the show for an invisible audience. And I'm so glad I do that now because of that difference, there's hesitation, but the show gets so much better if you force yourself to rehearse all out, even if it's a fake audience.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the things have changed, you know, your crew needs the timing for your speaking. The crew needs to get used to, you know, how long you spin this or your tone. And then it helps you, too, to really go as all out as you can in rehearsal.
Right. And do you change that from time to time, or when you come back to some of the same, in other words, when you're going to be, let's say, working in a venue for a while, let's say it's going to be in Branson or wherever it might be, I assume that you have the same show for a long time, but do you change out something, one or two things a year in your show? Okay.
Well, I might have an idea. We might change out something I've done for years. We might want to just change the way we do it. Or I might say, hey, what if we did it this way? What if we try this? But kind of every day is a warm-up for the cast and the crew. I like to run a few things, you know, when we get there. You know, if a band or an orchestra was there, they would always tune in and warm up at the show.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of magicians don't do that. So what we would do, you know, everyone's been out. If we've been in the Bahamas, you know, the dancers have been at the beach all day, you know, or they've, you know, it's like, what can we do to bring us all back in as a group? So we perform one or two illusions every day, all out, you know, before we open the doors, just so we all get warmed up for the show.
That makes sense, certainly.
But sometimes that's also the time we might play with, hey, one day it might be, what if we tried this illusion this way, or what if we move this around here? But we try to do things just to bring everyone's focus into the show, mm-hmm. and also just really, it's a muscle memory warm-up.
What about music?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, as far as ASCAP and everything else, I mean, do you have original music, or you have someone who writes this?
I have a combination. Some of it's been custom written, some is, you know, with the royalties and the licenses.
Mm-hmm.
And but so, the music is critical. Music is one of the most important parts of the show and the illusion.
It
sets the tone and the mood and the emotions.
Mm-hmm. And so is that something else that the director works with and helps you, saying, hey, perhaps you need to have this toned down or louder or different?
Definitely. I mean, I've had directors suggest different things or say, you know, try it this way. But most of the time when I work on illusion, I kind of send all the storyboards and the drafts to the whole team. You know, I've got, you know, some magic ideas, magic friends I bounce ideas off of. I've got scenic designers who take my really crude napkin sketches and make, you know, great storyboards and presentations for what we could make it look like. I've got, you know, the builder side of things. And I also have the director side of, you know, so I try to get everyone in the mood and understand it. So the music can be part of the process early on. Mm-hmm. So that everyone knows the feeling we're going for, because, you know, if there's a question on you know, the shape of something or the color of something or the build of something, or does this need to fly in fast or slow, the more everyone's on the team and understands what I'm thinking from the get-go, the more we're working in concert.
And when you're working with a director, is that somebody you just kind of go in or have them come in every once in a while for a tune-up and say, am I still on target, or have you got any other changes or something? They don't travel with you, I assume. They just kind of...
No, exactly. You know, like, if we film a TV thing, we will, like when we did AGT or Game of Towns for Fox, we took things we've been doing, but we know you have to restage it for the camera.
Sure.
So we, like, when we were in, you know, the show, we would rehearse the illusion the AGT way, then we'd do our show way that night. So, you know, because we would restage things because it's completely different camera versus live. Mm-hmm. So, or if we're putting a new thing in the show, they'll come in and work on that. Or if we're relaunching the show in a new place with a new cast or new dancers or a refresh time, we'll bring a director in. So it's a regular thing, but not a daily thing.
Is water levitation one of your favorite illusions?
It is. It is. It is. It's the crew's least favorite because there's water, you know, because everything's wet. No, but and it's huge. It's a massive. It's like 12 foot long and like 6 or 7 foot deep, and it's, you know, double layered fountain and tons of scenery. So it looks. You hear the audience gasp when the curtain opens because no one expects the stage to have that much scenery on it.
Right. Ray Anderson does this at Esther's Follies in Austin. Yeah. I don't know if you have you ever seen him perform.
Yeah, I love Esther's Follies. I actually talked to him yesterday and told him it's my favorite thing in Texas.
It's one of my favorite things in the world. I tell people to go there all the time.
I wish his Frank the Magician character would do the full show. I laugh so hard every time.
Frank is amazing. But his water levitation is basically just a blow up pool, and he's got that like just 2 feet from the front first row of the audience, and there are people behind the window, you know, watching this. It's amazing. Whereas yours, as you talk about, which is Hennings, was much more theatrical and huge, but he's just right there, you know. It's amazing.
Exactly. You know, there's something, you know, I remember that was one of the things I remember most when I saw Kirby's show in Branson the first time, and that's probably why I like it so much. You know, there were three illusions in a show that really, really gripped me, and they still have gripped me. That was one of them for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's going to stay in your show forever.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's too big of a piece, and I mean, it's the poster image. You know, the flaming hoop over the girl is such a money shot for the billboard. You know, there's most of my billboards have that shot, so it's, you know, you got to keep that in there.
Yeah. When you do television promos, is there a go-to trick that you do, or you just kind of, because obviously you have to, they'll probably show some videos, or you got a promo sizzle reel or something that they will show as they're talking with you. But then when you're doing a morning talk show or something on the television in the local area, is there something that you do regularly, or do you kind of look to see what it is that's current that magicians like or just doing, or is there and do you like close up? You've done something like
I love close up. You know, I started doing, you know, I still always have sponge balls and invisible deck in my bag or travel bag. You know, those are my go-to. I've been my go-to since I was a kid.
Okay.
So, before the talk shows, you know, like you asked earlier, you know, there's the illusionists are a dying breed. You know, very few people are doing illusion shows anymore. Mm-hmm. And this perception of magic is close-up magic or Instagram magic or, you know, street magic now.
Right.
So whenever I do the morning talk shows, which happens most of the places I travel to, you know, I do the morning shows. We have to, you know, ask them. We say, yes, I will happily do some amazing tricks with your host, but please show the viewers, you know, some of our B-roll clips. Because they don't understand what I do.
Right.
There's, you know, they've got to understand this is, you know, yes, I might be doing card tricks with your host on the show or reading the Weather Girl's mind.
But that's not what my show is about.
That's not what we're promoting. We're promoting the big show. So if as long as they will show the B-roll clips, you know, of the water fountain and the motorcycle and, you know, the big illusions, I'm happy to do stuff because I have fun doing that stuff. Yeah. But my go-to always is the invisible deck. That's always my go-to.
Yeah. That's a good one.
I love it. I just have fun doing it.
Sure, you are. Yeah. Well, as we start to wrap up, I want to kind of go full circle to go back what I did mention about that, and you brought up there again, and that is a lot of people are not going into illusions and performing for a variety of reasons. And why, without me putting words in your mouth, why do you think that is?
I think it's a lot of work, to be honest. You know, I think it's you know, I have to have a warehouse year round and a staff year round, and it takes tons of semi trucks, and it's a big expense. I also think things to go through cycles. You know, I think, you know, it's depends on what's on TV, and, you know, we're in an industry of emulation a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we haven't had magic illusion TV specials in decades. And I think I think it's a combination of everything. I think it's just the workload it takes and which means you got to be able to charge a lot more money for it, which means you got to find the promoters or the venues willing to pay that much money to cover your expenses. So I think it's a lot of factors, to be honest.
Right. I think it is a lot of factors. And I went back to originally also talking about the venues, trying to find the places to go and perform. And in some places, obviously, not even having loading docks.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of a thing then, too. And you got a very good point, though, too, Rob, where we haven't seen those kinds of large illusion shows for years, for decades. I mean, since Copperfield had done it. I mean, now we've been seeing Criss Angel or David Blaine or others doing some
more of the street magic stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Close-up kinds of things. And, but Masters of Illusion is something occasionally, like you said, you were on. You've had some illusions.
I have filmed recently with them again.
Yeah. But Penn & Teller is popular and show, and that's something they don't do big illusions.
You know, we've talked to them, and like, there's literally like no way, the way their stage is built with their video wall, there's no way to get my props out there unless they're carried over the audience. It's just one of those, it's logistically not really designed for illusions. So we've talked to them before, and just it's like logistically, it's like probably it's like ends up feeling like it's not worth their effort.
You almost need to take the prop apart and reassemble it on stage.
And then like carry down the aisle to get on stage. Yeah, so it's just like not a, you know.
Holy moly!
But no, it's a hit show. I love the show. I really respect Penn & Teller. It's a great show. It's not designed to accommodate big illusions.
Well, there have been a couple that have been on there, and I've seen Greg Wilson, who produces Dad, Mark, and a few other kinds of things, I think. But for the most part, yeah, it's not. Or else there have been people who have shown videos of illusions, and that's okay, too. But I think they want to have something that's going to be on that stage, because if they win, they're going to bring you in. And if you can't bring it in, then you're probably not going to win.
Totally. Absolutely. So yeah, it's a cycle. So I think... You know, I think there's a, you know, it's a, you know, like I said, I've been very lucky to perform, you know, all over the globe and in theaters and casinos and resorts and arenas. But I realized, you know, when I grew up, you know, my parents would take me to see all the shows. I saw Kirby Van Burch and Brett Daniels and Siegfried Roy and Lance Burton, you know, countless times I saw those guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, my poor parents had to take me to every Magic and Illusion show, but most of the shows you would go see were the illusion shows.
Well, again, being in Oklahoma, you were a pretty far piece away from going to see any of those large shows, unless they happen to be touring through the state.
Correct.
But most of them have been in larger venues.
Absolutely. Definitely. Mm-hmm. You know, I would have to, you know, I'd come to Texas to see, you know, if David Copperfield was touring or something else, or even Cirque du Soleil, you know, we'd go there. So, you know, it's just, you know, I was really lucky. My parents helped me go on these trips to learn and grow and see these magic greats. But I have all the memories of seeing these, you know, my generation's legends, you know, the Kirby's and Brett Daniels and others who are, luckily, I'm able to call a lot of them friends now.
This is kind of out of left field, but all the different places you've traveled, is there some place that you really enjoyed that you love? I mean, personally, I just love South Lake Tahoe. It's just a beautiful.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's great.
It's stunning. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. I loved it. You know, when the show is almost the same because we bring all the lights, all the sets. You know, we turn the theater into our stage, so it looks, for me, it looks the exact same no matter where we are.
Yeah.
But it's really about, what city do I want to be in when the show's over?
Yeah, that's my question. I mean, is there some around the world from where you've been? It's kind of like,
my
like to
favorite
go to the beach.
City is London.
Okay,
I really love London. I'm there a lot. I love Tokyo as well. I fell in love with Japan for my first break back in the day.
Yeah.
Singapore is a great. I mean, I love traveling. I love exploring. I love being adventurous. So in the U.S. and New York is a favorite place of mine. And then I'm in L.A. a lot. So
it sounds like more the city as opposed to the beach area.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I lived in the Bahamas for 3.5 years, you know, doing the show at Atlantis, and I literally lived on the beach. So I think I had my fix of the beach. Not I still love it. I still love it. It's like, and you know, I also kind of got island fever there. So it's, for me, it's, you know, I think probably where I can see more humans and more restaurants and more options, you know.
Someone had asked me once, are you a beach person or a mountain person? And I have to say, I'm more of a mountain person. I just think that's beautiful. I'd spend more time there than I would.
I'd probably be more of a beach person myself, but I mean, I like it all. I mean, I like to travel. But...
Well, yeah, that's true. Well, of course, let's wrap up then with my question I always ask. And since you're a listener, what is your magic word? What is your phrase? What do you live by?
Wonder.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. You know, I think the ultimate goal is to provide wonder for the audience, especially in, you know, when the world is crazy all around us. Just for a moment, even if somebody's skeptical, if I can provide wonder, then I've achieved my goal.
So provide wonder. Yeah.
Yeah.
To everyone. Wow. That's great.
Including myself. So
you live this yourself?
Including providing wonder, you know, keep the wonder for myself so I don't get burned out. You're finding the wonder for myself. Like watching a Doug Henning illusion, he looks as amazed by the magic of the wonder as the audience. So it's like,
I was just talking to Chip Romero about that very thing, about the psychology of what it is about Doug's show, where he was so excited that you were excited about what he did. So it was
It's like he believed the magic. And, you know, watching Doug videos never gets old.
Yeah. Yeah.
It never gets old. So, well, but he encompasses wonder. He is just full of wonder.
That's exactly right. That's a good way of ending over there. Rob, thank you so very much. This has been just a fantastic chat, and I can't believe that an hour has gone by over here. So thanks very much for sharing all that you have.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
It's been great. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Rob Lake. This is Scotty out.
Thank you very much, Rob. I appreciate you being my guest here this week on the Magic Word Podcast. So glad that you are a listener, and also for the rest of you in the world who are listening, I thank you for listening to this as well. I hope you got as much out of this as I did. I just thought this was another fantastic conversation with a conjurer. And if you enjoy these, please help support us with your financial pledge. If you'll go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there you will find a link where you can join the Friends of the Magic Word, and that way you can learn about pledging through Patreon or making a donation through PayPal, however you want and whatever amount, that would be greatly appreciated and certainly help this podcast to continue on into the future, because we have a lot of expenses each week and an ongoing every month with everything we have to do with our domain charges, our software, hardware, and internet, etc. Anyhow, thank you guys very much, and I appreciate you considering a financial donation or a pledge to the Magic Word. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to always provide wonder to your audience. This is Scotty out.